is commanded.
Please be seated. Afternoon, we'll call our first case for this afternoon, and only case, 2006 AP 1826 CRAC, State of Wisconsin v. Schaefer. Ms. Stilling, Attorney Stilling, representing Ronald Schaefer, will present the first argument. Counsel?
May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Kathleen Stilling, and I represent Ronald Schaefer, the defendant in this interlocutory appeal which has been certified to this Court. I ask this Court to confirm that Mr. Schaefer has the right to obtain police reports by use of subpoena prior to the preliminary hearing. There are at least four reasons why this Court should do so. I would like to mention them briefly and then review each one in turn. First of all, criminal defendants in the state of Wisconsin have a broad subpoena right to subpoena witnesses and documents or evidence to any court proceeding, action, or matter pending before a court. This includes all phases of a criminal case. Second, this Court should not construe Lynch to apply to the facts of this case. However, that being said, if the Court does apply the facts of the Lynch case to this case, I would ask that the Court find that Mr. Schaefer has a particularized need under the exception carved out in Lynch, and on that narrow ground, the Court can grant relief in this case. But more broadly, there are two additional reasons why I believe this Court should grant relief. Schaefer, like any other defendant, has the right to the effective assistance of counsel at this critical stage of the proceeding. In order to be effective, counsel must have the information that is necessary to prepare and conduct the hearing in an effort to attack the plausibility of the state's case. Also, Schaefer has the right to compulsory process under the state and federal constitution, which are guaranteed by this state, and should have the opportunity to utilize either one of those rights in order to obtain the subpoena. This Court can reverse the trial court decision quashing the subpoena on any one or a combination of those grounds. Let me turn now to a brief discussion of those grounds. Sections 88501 and 80507 confer a broad authority on all litigants in this state. The plain language of the statute says that witnesses may be called to testify or produce documents or both. There are no explicit restrictions on the type of proceeding to which a witness may be subpoenaed. It need only be any action, matter, or proceeding pending before a court or other person certified to take testimony in this state, and that would include the court commissioner in this case. There are no express restrictions on the class of witness who can be subpoenaed. There is no police officer exception or police report exception. The legislature has also granted our trial courts broad authority to manage their calendars by use of Section 80210, which allows the court to set appropriate scheduling in order to manage its cases. The plain language of 97211 adopts the civil procedure statutes that I've just discussed for use in criminal proceedings. This includes, without limitation, the use of subpoenas at every phase of a criminal case.
Ms. Stilling, what about the fact that Chapter 971 seems to be very specific in terms of discovery, and that that's a much more specific statute than the sections you referred to, 80501 and 80507, and therefore controls?
I don't believe that Section 97131 controls in this case. Section 971 sets forth what the state is required or obligated to give to a defendant, and that is certain limited items which they are obligated to turn over at a reasonable time prior to trial. And these are all items which they intend to use at trial. So the focus of the discovery statutes is for this – is the State's relationship with the criminal defendant and what they are obligated to turn over. 97131, which the State cites as being controlling here, only prohibits the defense from filing a discovery motion. In other words, a motion to obtain those items which the State is obligated to produce and which they intend to use at trial. There is nothing in Section 971 that prohibits a defendant from using any other lawful means to obtain information about their case, including subpoenas to third parties in order to obtain that information. So I don't believe that 971 controls, as the State would imply in this case.
Ms. Dilling, assuming 971 does not control, you issue a subpoena for a party in anticipation of a preliminary hearing. When does the subpoena have to be acted upon?
In this case, I filed the subpoena along with a notice to the State that I was doing so. And I had it scheduled 3 days before the preliminary hearing.
And was that at another hearing? Was there a separate hearing that was scheduled?
I called the clerk and asked to schedule a court date before the court commissioner who was to hear the preliminary hearing for the purpose of having a return on that subpoena. And I did that after looking at the process that's used in the State of Illinois after the Supreme Court granted a similar power to defendants in that state in People ex rel. Carey versus Fisher. So I used a similar procedure to the one used in the State of Illinois.
The reason I'm asking a question is I know your argument is premised on 80507 sub 1 and 2. And 80507 sub 1 is to compel attendance of witnesses for deposition, hearing, or trial. Now, granted that hearing seems to connote something more than a trial, it still seems to suggest that there is a proceeding that's taking place. And if I understand your brief correctly, it sounds like you're asking for a proceeding in anticipation of a proceeding.
I'm not asking for this court to actually set a procedure. I'm suggesting that under 80210, the trial courts in every county have the inherent authority to set up whatever procedure works best if this court decides that we have the power to issue these subpoenas.
And I guess the reason I'm asking the question is, assuming for sake of the question that the power to issue a subpoena exists and is created by this section of the statute, why isn't the subpoena served at the preliminary hearing when the witness shows up to testify and brings with him or her the documents that have been requested, giving you an opportunity to look at them prior to the testimony?
Well, that would serve to give me some notice of what the witnesses have to say in preparation, but I don't believe that that would enable me to conduct the effective preparation that I should be able to do in order to provide the most to provide effective assistance of counsel to my client. Secondly, the legislature anticipates that this is an adversary hearing where we not only put on evidence, that we not only cross-examine witnesses, but we also put on evidence. And if I don't have this subpoena or I don't have this information, I'll be unable to identify witnesses. And I think that's particularly true in this unusual case where the allegations are that something occurred 16 years ago. And contrary to what the State says, I'm unable to conduct any independent investigation at this point because of the stale nature of the accusations, as well as the fact that the only witness listed in this complaint isn't even identified by name. So
can I backtrack just a little bit?
Yes.
Is this a subpoena to a party or a third party in your mind?
In my mind, this is a subpoena to a third party, which is the Brookfield Police Department, a municipal law enforcement authority.
So then if you are proceeding under 80507, 1B or 2B requires that be at least 10 days before scheduled deposition.
The State actually asserted that we were going under 2B, but I was going under the Section A or 1A. I'm sorry. It's not a deposition subpoena. The section above that discusses the use of subpoenas under other circumstances, and that was the section I was relying on.
So what is the hearing that you're having, and why not conduct it like a civil lawyer would have to conduct a deposition or a return of records in a civil case, pay for the court reporter, and pay for the witnesses, the cost of the witness, if you're proceeding under the civil statute and that applies?
Well, there's no authorization under 972.11 to take a deposition in criminal court. However, this 972.11 specifically authorizes the use of subpoenas to produce documents and or evidence. And so I would be going under that section.
Oh, so it's not 80507 that you're proceeding under?
It's 80507 and 80501.
Why aren't you under 805073 and that you just did it ahead of the state? I mean, you would assume the state's going to object, right?
I assume the state was going to object.
And the 3 says, upon motion made promptly and in any event before, at or before the time specified in the subpoena would have been for the preliminary hearing, right? So right?
The subpoena was for a day prior to the preliminary hearing so that I could obtain any documents that were not considered privileged.
Okay. So why don't you come under 3? And that what you did was you just asked the court before the state could ask the court.
I also thought that it would be appropriate to notify the state so that if there were any objections to privileged documents, mm-hmm. yes, those could be dealt with ahead of time.
Okay.
Now, the state's saying that this is a radical departure, but really the state's suggestion is the radical one. The state is attempting to say that there's no authority for criminal defendants to issue a subpoena in any criminal case before the trial. There is absolutely no authority for that position, and the state has failed to show any. Now, the state is also implying that there's going to be chaos if this court grants relief in this case, but if all criminal defendants issued similar subpoenas to this one, the institutions would adapt to that process the same way they did in Illinois. And there are also examples in Wisconsin where, according to public policies in certain counties, the prosecutors automatically turn over all the police reports prior to the preliminary hearing. And, in fact, in Washington County, that is a procedure that's regularly followed. And at that point, the court often will schedule a date to find out if the defendant wants a preliminary hearing. And after the defendant and his lawyer have reviewed the materials, they get an opportunity to state whether they're going to request a preliminary hearing. This is a very good and very efficient use of the court's time. It means that if there
are... The concept that in the state's brief, I think it's in a reply to the amicus brief, if I'm remembering it right, that indicates, oh, you'll need protective orders for informants' names. There may be other confidential information that should not be released, and that you're going to have all of the burdens that are outlined in a lot of materials on civil discovery. I know you keep saying it's not discovery, but that, that this will just grind to a standstill, and there's a reference that, okay, New York City does it, but that they had 100,000 such requests, and I'd have forgotten what the time period was. That's a larger metropolis than we have in the entire state in terms of population, but nevertheless, sounded convincing to me.
Well, I would say that in most cases, there is little or no privileged information contained in police reports. Most police reports that are turned over later by the state after the preliminary hearing contain just the investigative reports of interviews that the police have conducted with witnesses. Every now and then, there may be some confidential information, such as medical reports or confidential informants' names or something like that. But in those cases, the police can target those files and can make the appropriate motions for a protective order. Or in the
event... Who's going to represent the police?
Excuse me?
Who's going to represent the police at these hearings?
Well, I would say that the city attorney could represent the police in these matters, and that would be appropriate, or I suppose the city attorney could turn over that responsibility to the prosecutor.
Will the police department need a counsel on hand to look at these files and determine confidentiality?
Well, I would say most likely no, because police departments under open records laws routinely have to make determinations about whether there are confidential materials in police reports before they can respond to open records requests. So I think a lot of that expertise is already there. Also, when the police bring cases in for charging, they'll typically make extra copies of the reports for the prosecutor and possibly even the defense later. And in those, during the charging phase, the prosecutor may also be able to identify any information that may be confidential or require some sort of protective order. But really, in the vast majority of cases, at least in my practice, those records really don't exist, particularly at that early phase.
Why didn't you request the records directly from the prosecutor if the prosecutors generally have these reports?
Because if I request them directly from the prosecutor, then it is discovery. Because discovery, either by statute or under a more traditional definition, are those documents or that evidence that you request directly from the state.
Well, isn't this kind of a little bit of form over substance then?
Well, I know the state has made an argument that the state really is the same thing as the police department, but I would disagree. And I think that when we look at the cases where the relationship between the police department and the prosecution is outlined, such as the DeLeo case, which was cited by the state, really the focus of the case is not that they're an identical entity. It's really that the prosecutor has an independent duty to exercise due diligence to find out information that's contained within the knowledge of the police department that's regularly reporting to her. And so really it wasn't that they were punishing her for the police failures. It was they were punishing the state for the state's failure to exercise due diligence. And in fact, the state is not required to go outside the purview of those departments that are regularly reporting on a case. So really, I don't think that those cases support what the state is saying here. And in fact, if we took that argument to its logical conclusion, that really the police are part of the state and part of the party, then we could never have a police officer sit on a jury because they'd have a conflict. They'd be a member of the prosecution team. We could ask for instructions to the jury that the police have an automatic bias because they are the prosecution. So I really think that it is in the best interest of society as well as the court system if we maintain the function of the police as a neutral, independent, investigative force, which, as the amicus suggested, really should be seen as a neutral force which provides information for all the parties.
Counsel, to look at this from the perspective of the defendant has the right to a preliminary hearing within 10 days if they're in custody and 20 days if they're released from custody. In a smaller county or in many counties around the state, they might not have court commissioners. Court commissioners might be the people who hear preliminary hearings in larger counties, but the resources and time available to get the schedules of defense counsel, the prosecutor, law enforcement, and get the records, and then have a court commissioner ready and available to conduct these hearings. Who bears that expense, and what's the outcome if a defendant wants their prelim within 10 days? And a prelim is kind of the first line of attack to see whether or not the state's case survives further. And having been someone who sat there and has dismissed cases at prelim and also has bound people over after prelim, I understand that that's, you know, a basic, fundamental, early proceeding where the state has to produce certain plausible accounts of the evidence in order for the case to survive. If a defendant wants that right, wants it within 10 days, and this can't be done within 10 days, is the case then to be dismissed, or is counsel ineffective, or what would be the outcome there if it just isn't going to get done? And that's not unrealistic. Sometimes it's hard enough to schedule a prelim within 10 days. It puts defense counsel, frankly, in a box, because if they don't get it done, they're ineffective. And if they need to delay it, then the defendant, a very fundamental principle, is being thwarted.
Well, I think that in that case, let me think about the procedure in a little different way. When a case comes in for charging, typically the police will bring in copies of the police reports. There will be extra copies available. And it seems to me that even in smaller counties, there could be a process set up such that those defendants or defense counsel that want to obtain a copy of the reports by subpoena And the onus is going to be on defense counsel to make the appropriate subpoena, to serve it, and to make sure that they are available to go and get those records at the time that they become available. And then I think it would be up to each county to set up the process by which this could be effected. But for some defendants, it may be that they have to make a judgment about whether this is important enough to them such that they'll waive their time limits or not, or that there may be a motion for cause to extend the preliminary hearing or continue it until certain records can be provided. And that relief is provided in the statute, and there are many times when, because of a witness unavailability or other issues, prelims are continued, and they're for good cause. And I think this could be another example of when good cause would could be used.
Tell me of the particularized need here.
In this case, because of the extremely old allegations, there really is a particularized need. In order to try and determine what, if any, witnesses I can put on in order to attack the probable cause of what this 30-year-old woman is saying occurred 16 years ago when she was the age of 14, I would need to see records in order to determine what witnesses would have any recollection of events that occurred over a 4 or 5 month period 16 years ago. So if I am to have any hope of putting on any testimony, as we are allowed to do by statute, I've got to find out who those witnesses are. The complaint tells me nothing. Secondly, if I want to even try to interview this witness to see if maybe there are other parts of this story that render what she says implausible, I can't even identify who she is. Third, there are some specific facts contained in the complaint that are a little bit unusual and which may be critical to probable cause here. She identifies some documents that she provided to the police department, which she said were love notes. And yet the prosecutor, who typically will put in their best case scenario in a complaint, references nothing that looks like a love note in that complaint. The only phrase he picked out of all of the notes she claims she kept and turned over was a phrase that's highly ambiguous and maybe taken out of context. What if the other notes in the possession of the police department say things like, good job on your last test, Carrie, or, you know, nice job at the basketball game, and this woman interprets those as love notes? She could have such a delusional idea of this relationship, it could render the plausibility of her entire story very suspect. So I think there are a number of issues here. Plus, I think we've all seen cases, particularly those of us who have been in trial courts, where sometimes you do get those moments when witnesses are pressed on issues and they admit that they're wrong. She could be thinking about a different male teacher she had 16 years ago or 15 years ago. She could be making a mistake about who this is after all these years. She could also just admit that she's lying. And it is possible that what we could present at a preliminary hearing with the use of this information might not result in a dismissal that day, but it might result in the prosecutor looking at the case a different way in light of the information presented at the preliminary hearing, in light of his witness's testimony, and may decide at some point later to dismiss or reduce the charges or come to some other resolution that may still be fair and in the best interest of the community.
Counsel, let me ask, because I understand your argument and the need for wanting to get some of these materials in advance, but I also understand the Lynch case and the fact that it's previously held that we don't have discovery for purposes of the preliminary hearing stage. So in trying to read the statutes together and trying to make some sense and looking at 805 and 8085, in looking at the specifics of this case, it seems to me that one of the things that you could do under the statutes without doing harm to the statutes is issue a subpoena for the preliminary hearing of the officer as you've done it. But you've asked for it to be 3 days in advance of the hearing. Why not just issue a subpoena for the preliminary hearing, have the officer come in with the materials that they have, review them. If you have enough to do the cross-examination, the preliminary hearing goes on as scheduled. There's no delay. The defendant has their preliminary hearing within the time frame, and you move on. If you, on the other hand, uncover additional information that was unanticipated that quite frankly, might make a difference in how the prelim might go, then ask for an adjournment of the preliminary hearing, which then precludes the need for having a separate proceeding in every case, but allows the defendant the opportunity to prepare based on the evidence that was subpoenaed properly for the hearing. I don't see why you can't have that. You know, you issue a subpoena for the prelim, you go in prepared to do the prelim, or you review the materials before you start. I'm not aware of any prosecutors that would hold back at that stage. I haven't experienced that. So you sit there and you see the materials, you're ready to go, or you're not ready to go. Judge, I need an adjournment. There's materials here that are relevant to the prelim. There's evidence that we might want to offer and introduce, and then the judge will have the opportunity, the court commissioner will have the opportunity of starting it and then adjourning it to give you an opportunity to present evidence, or else just postponing the entire thing. Why doesn't that work?
Well, I would anticipate, with all due respect to the justice, that there would be an objection, and in fact that the state would be reluctant to turn over anything, even at the preliminary hearing, unless it's something that one of the officers reviewed in order to refresh their recollection. And in fact, my experience is that as a practice, officers review very often in some places such as Milwaukee only the complaint so that they don't have to turn over the reports at the preliminary hearing. So I would anticipate that I would receive the same objection at the preliminary hearing as I would before then. In addition, I think that it would be hard to convince most preliminary hearing courts to adjourn the hearing when all the witnesses are there because I haven't had adequate time to really analyze the information so that I can do what I think the legislature intended us to do, which is really put on a good adversary hearing to reveal weaknesses in the state's case that would go unchallenged until trial otherwise.
I inferred from your answer to Justice Bradley that you did not know who the complaining witness was. Is that right?
I do not know who the complaining witness is myself.
Have you asked?
I would say without revealing any client confidences, which I can't do, I would say that Mr. Schaefer was a teacher for a number of years before 1990, and has been a teacher for 16 years since that time. He's taught hundreds of students. Being able to identify a student from 16 years ago by an initial and a first name, we may be able to narrow that down somewhat, but it still won't necessarily tell us who this woman is now. She may have a married name. I have no idea where her location is. A name and an initial really is not enough to conduct an investigation.
But do I understand that the state has not told you who the complaining witness is? I mean, did you ever ask? A.B. Who is A.B.?
Ann Bradley.
Oh, I'm sorry. No.
C.D. Oh, okay.
C.D. I mean, who is C.D.? I mean,
well, as the state has said, I'm only entitled to the information that's contained in the complaint, and that's their position. I don't think I would get much relief from the prosecutor if I said, oh, I'd like her name and address so I can go get an investigator out to go see her. But if the court would permit, I'd like to address the state and federal compulsory process clause arguments here. We're also raising the arguments under the compulsory process clause of not only our federal but our state constitution. And although the state has debated whether the Burr case applies, I think it quite clearly demonstrates that the framers of the Constitution intended the defendant to be able to compel the production of documents as soon as he's brought to court. The idea is that you need to be able to prepare quickly for your defense. And, in fact, this court in State versus Harper also told defense counsel that we're to conduct a prompt investigation of all the facts that are relevant to the state's case or the question of guilt or innocence as soon as possible and to try to obtain the information contained in the police files, not just the state. So I see that my time is up.
Yes, ma'am.
But I thank you very much.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court?
Go ahead.
Assistant Attorney General Daniel O'Brien appears on behalf of the State of Wisconsin. Counsel for Schaefer argues that they are not seeking discovery prior to the preliminary hearing. They acknowledge that they can't make that argument without having this court expressly overrule State ex rel Lynch v. Circuit Court. But what is it that they are doing? Are they subpoenaing a specific witness to testify at the preliminary hearing to present evidence specifically relevant to the issue of plausibility of the State's proof of a commission of a felony? No. As Justice Butler so aptly put it, they're subpoenaing a witness to appear at a hearing in anticipation of a hearing. It's a procedure unknown to Wisconsin law. Is it a specific subpoena duces tecum to bring a specific item of evidence, or as 885.01 refers to it, an instrument of evidence relevant to the issue of plausibility of the preliminary hearing at that hearing? No. Then what is it? It is a subpoena duces tecum that has no standards. It is a subpoena duces tecum that tells any third party, in this case, the Brookfield Police Department, but it could be applicable to any third party, any school, any therapist, any hospital, any third party to bring anything you got on the defendant to a hearing in anticipation of a hearing.
Mr. O'Brien, is it your argument? I understand your argument about the hearing in anticipation of the preliminary hearing. I'm not quite sure what your position is with respect to the preliminary hearing itself. You are not arguing, are you, that the defense can't subpoena the Brookfield police chief to come in and testify at the prelim, correct?
The general answer to your question is no, I'm not making that argument. I think the defense can subpoena a witness in his behalf at a preliminary hearing, but that witness had better be prepared to present evidence that is relevant and potentially exculpatory on the issue of plausibility.
What is to keep a defendant from subpoenaing the chief at the preliminary hearing itself? I'm not talking about an anticipation of it, but at the preliminary hearing itself, subpoenaing the chief to bring in the police reports that the chief has in his or her possession that are relevant to the preliminary hearing and the issue of plausibility. What's to preclude the defense from subpoenaing the chief for that purpose?
Well, I don't believe that they can subpoena the chief to bring in the documents that are listed in this specific subpoena, that it's just basically bring in anything you've got on the defendant with regard to criminal offenses or relating to the alleged sexual contact. That's basically an open-ended discovery request. That's really what it is. And that is specifically prohibited by this court in State v. Knutson, which is a case that preceded Lynch, 51 with second 280-81. And I have to, in all candor, did not cite Knutson in my brief. I felt it was subsumed by the Lynch case. But when I went back and read through the transcripts of the July 13 and July 18 hearings with respect to the subpoena in the circuit court, the Knutson case was discussed at length. And in Knutson, the defense did precisely what you suggest. They subpoenaed the chief of police to bring in whatever you got on the defendant because we want to see whether there's anything relevant there. And this court said, no, you can't do that. That's using the prelim as a discovery device. That's trying to search for impeachment evidence, which is not allowed at a preliminary hearing. You have to be very specific. And whether we're talking about statutory law or constitutional law, every case that talks about the use of a subpoena, whether it's a subpoena ad testificandum or a subpoena duces tecum, talks about you can't issue that subpoena unless it's specifically relevant to a specific issue. And moreover, the United States Supreme Court in Valenzuela Bernal said the compulsory process does not authorize the issuance of a subpoena unless you can show that that subpoena will produce evidence that is not only relevant but favorable to the defense. So there is no statutory or constitutional authority anywhere for a general, open-ended, standardless investigative subpoena to help the defense investigate a case. There is in civil law, but I find it's really interesting that counsel argues that 972.11 opens the door and lets in the civil discovery rule, well, the civil rules on subpoena, and yet counsel does not rely on the three most applicable statutes. Again, they're trying to obtain documents. They're trying to compel third parties to produce documents. They're trying to discover what these witnesses may have. And there are very specific procedures in the civil procedure rules that provide for that, 804.01 paren 2, 804.09 paren 3, and most revealing, 805.07 paren 2 paren B. Counsel says, well, I don't want to rely on paren B. Well, she can't, because by its express terms, it clearly applies only to civil proceedings. And because it has the word discovery in its title, it defeat counsel's argument that this is not discovery.
What does discovery mean? Is there a definition?
I'm sorry?
What is the definition of discovery?
Well, I think 804.01 provides a pretty good definition. 971.23 provides discovery in criminal cases and sort of sets out what has to be provided.
At a particular stage, what does discovery mean under 804.01 or in the civil cases?
Okay, do I have that here? You know, it's basically access to the other party's evidence, or at least witness statements, witness statements, whatnot. Okay. But I think it's interesting that they can't rely on those very specific provisions because 971.23 occupies the same field. So the legislature made specific civil discovery provisions and civil production of document provisions available, just as they did in criminal code.
Is discovery limited to a party or party's agent, like under C?
Well,
I mean, that's what I hear as part of
except 804.09 sub 3 is not limited to a party. It's specifically third party. And 805.07 sub 2B is third parties. Third persons, not third party is a bad term. It's a third person, not a party to the action. And so that's precisely what they're trying to do here, is get access to evidence in the hands of a third party.
Okay, but I thought you said 805.07.2b is only related to civil, right? So that doesn't cover us.
That's my understanding.
What does 804.09.3 say? Trying to find out whether... Well, one, is this discovery, and what difference does it make if it's discovery or not?
But it just seems that none of these provisions, 804.09 sub 3, the rule does not preclude. This is the rule allowing parties to obtain, to force production of documents from other parties, but then it's 803 does not prohibit.
So 804.09.1 and 2 relate to parties.
But sub 3 does not preclude
an
independent action against a person, not a party, for production of documents.
I don't know what an independent action means. It may mean a subpoena.
What's that?
I said I don't know what independent action means.
Oh, it sounds like some sort of a special captioned proceeding.
Like a subpoena, maybe.
In a civil case, yeah.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I mean,
discovery provision doesn't seem to apply.
It doesn't seem
to
apply because the context manifestly requires, and it's in the civil chapter dealing with discovery and depositions. And as we're pointing out, 971.23 already provides for discovery and depositions, and in criminal case, and, well, 971.23 and 967.04 provides for criminal depositions as well as production of documents in criminal actions as well. And so
discovery, like under 804.01, if you look at 2C, you look for discovery from a party because you can't get it from another means. Well, here it's not from the party. You're trying to get it from another means, assuming you don't view the police and the state as one party here.
Which I don't know how you can't. I mean, if we were to make that argument after Bindover, we'd be slapped down, because Kiles v. Whitley, the U.S. Supreme Court clearly said that once the prosecution's commenced, the state is responsible for the records in the hands of the law enforcement agency. You don't get around Brady v. Maryland by saying, oh, the police had it. And in this case, the criminal complaint was signed not only by the assistant district attorney, but by a detective. The charges had already been filed, at least at the post-complaint stage. I think it makes perfect sense to treat one and the same, to treat these, you know, that the prosecutor now becomes responsible. Once those charges are brought, he's responsible for evidence within his control, his or her control, whether that's evidence obtained by law enforcement agencies or someone else. And I think the U.S. Supreme Court case law is pretty clear on that. So there is a question whether this is even a third party, but if you assume it is, then that really opens a Pandora's box, because if you're saying Brookfield police are not under the control of the district attorney, but you can subpoena anything from them, no matter, even though you can't show relevance, then you can go to any third party. And we will be seeing subpoenas thrown at schools and therapists and anyone else who might have information about the defendant or the victim.
What about Illinois? You know, last I looked, it was still here. And I look at the Fisher versus Perry case. Obviously, it's a case that we're not bound by, but the analysis deals with, sounds to me like pretty much the same thing here. And they found, as I recall, in the compulsory, the right rather to compulsory process, a constitutional right. They said, you know, a preliminary hearing is an important, is a critical stage, they said, of the criminal proceeding, and you need to have a defense attorney, and you can either have a defense attorney sit as a bump on a log, or you can have a defense attorney that is effective, and in order to be effective, you have to be prepared. I'm at 268 of that case. And so, and I'm not saying they're right, but that's certainly an argument, and they gave it constitutional dimension, and it seems to be a case that could fit here.
Well, there's several problems with the Fisher v. Carey case, and of course, just before I came over here, I shepherdized it again. And the only cases outside of Illinois, this is almost a 30-year-old case, and the only cases outside of the state of Illinois, a few Illinois appellate decisions citing it, are two New York cases, one that counsel has cited in her favor and one that I've cited in my favor, that criticizing Fisher v. Carey, and a Seventh Circuit case using subpoenas in a 1983 action. So the most important point, well, there's two points. The Fisher case cites a case, People v. Adams, saying that appears to allow the use of a preliminary hearing to expose weaknesses in the state's case to fashion an impeachment tool and to discover the state's case. Well, none of that's allowed in Wisconsin. And the Knutson case that I just referred to earlier specifically disallows it, as does Lynch. You can put on evidence relative to plausibility, but you can't impeach witnesses at the preliminary hearing.
What
you can't discover.
Is giving, you know, taking it a statutory realm and giving it the constitutional dimension.
Well, and I would like to respond to that. On the compulsory process issue, People v. Carey was decided in 1979. It didn't have the benefit of the subsequent U.S. Supreme Court decisions in 1982 in United States v. Valenzuela Bernal, or 1987 Pennsylvania v. Ritchie, which specifically said compulsory process clause only entitles you to evidence that is relevant and favorable to your defense. And that is evidence that is relevant and favorable to your defense at trial. And I would hazard to guess that had this case been decided in 1989 instead of 1979, it might have produced a different result.
It's going to be favorable to your client if you don't know what it is?
I'm sorry?
How do you know whether the evidence in the police report is going to be favorable to your client when you don't even know what's in the police files?
Well,
it doesn't make any sense to me to say, oh, you can only do it favorable, but you don't know what it is, so you can't say it's favorable.
Well, I think Valenzuela Bernal provides a perfect example. There was a case where the chief witnesses the defendant was with the two witnesses who were deported under the immigration law out of the country. And the defense made that very argument, that how do you know, how do I know what these people had to say? And the Supreme Court responded very clearly, you were there. You know whether or not they have something to say. And that's the same thing here. There's enough specifics in this complaint that Mr. Schaefer could testify at the preliminary hearing. Look, I wasn't there that summer. I never had a student with those initials. And there's plenty of circumstantial evidence. I mean, these love notes, there's a specific love note quoted. You know, he can cross-examine the victim at the preliminary hearing and ask her, did you receive that love note? Did you, you know, there's enough here that a good defense attorney under the Harper standard can go out and start knocking on doors, making phone calls, making public record requests, whatever, to get information that might help him, certainly prior to the preliminary hearing. And in fact, that compulsory process standard, that applies before trial. I mean, so that argument could be made, too, before trial. I don't really know what this witness has. Well, you know, sometimes you have to be a little resourceful, and sometimes you'll get information from other people that will give you an idea of what's in there. And, you know, we, as in the Valenzuela-Burnell, counsel has her own client.
Counsel, in Brady, the state has the obligation to reveal exculpatory evidence. Right. So that would be one way for...
Well, that would be before trial. I believe that our case law does not require the disclosure of exculpatory evidence before a preliminary hearing. Having said that, I think if a prosecutor, you know, and again, this is a Lynch standard. The Lynch court said, you know, at this stage at least, you know, you do have to trust the prosecutor to some extent. But if the prosecutor has specific evidence that said he wasn't there, or he didn't do it, or this victim just made this up and it didn't happen, an ethical prosecutor, prosecutors are bound by the code of ethics, is going to not pursue the matter if he or she finds that out after the criminal complaint is filed. And then after the bind over, then Brady v. Maryland kicks in and the prosecutor has to disclose that evidence even if they're being unethical or the case will be dropped, will be overturned on appeal.
Do you know whether Illinois has the transactional relationship test where charges can change after prelim?
Well, you know, it's interesting. That was another point in that Fisher case, and this was a note at the end of the case where the court says we're going to limit it, the use of the subpoena because we understand that they could be used in an abusive fashion and as a discovery tool, and we don't want that. And so they go on and they say, here, we use the term loosely to encompass the time prior to preliminary hearing during which it is or becomes clear what offense an accused will be formally charged with. Well, that doesn't happen in Wisconsin. It's not clear what offense the accused will be charged with before the preliminary hearing. So, and to be honest with you, I'm not totally conversant with the Illinois procedure as to how it is you know the charge. Because in Wisconsin, as we well know from the many cases dealing with preliminary hearings, after bindover, the prosecutor can bring any charge or charges not wholly unrelated to the transactions or facts testified to at the preliminary hearing. So even even if we did what Justice Butler suggests, which is subpoena the witness to the hearing, which is preferable to having this hearing in anticipation, you still don't know what the charges are going to be at that point. And so you don't entirely know what's going to be relevant, what's going to be exculpatory at that point.
Let me ask you about that, Mr. O'Brien, because having done a number of prelims, both from the judicial aspect and from the practitioner aspect, I'm always concerned with how this stuff is actually going to play out in court. And one of the goals, I think, that happens early on in a proceeding is to make sure that the proceedings that need to take place, and the proceedings that don't need to take place get moved on, so that you're not wasting everybody's time. And my experience has always been, at the preliminary hearing stage, that most prosecutors are anxious to share the information they have with defense counsel because they want a waiver of the preliminary hearing, because when the defense counsel goes through it with the client, it's like, oh my God, we don't want to have this come out in court today, let's back off. And so a lot of times what will happen is you'll have that sharing of information, the prosecutor, look, this is what I got, take your time, let me know when you're ready. And that's how the preliminary hearing starts in many counties, obviously not in every county. And so coming from that experience, knowing that, the parties are anxious to move the proceedings on and waive the ones that need to be waived, have the hearings that need to be had, and knowing that the whole point of the preliminary hearing is to weed out the cases that shouldn't be around in the system, I guess I'm troubled with an argument that would suggest that at the prelim, and I'm not talking about the pre-prelim, I mean, I understand your argument there, but at the preliminary hearing itself, when the witnesses are there, when the police reports are there, when the defendant is there to hear what's against him or her, that it wouldn't be to everyone's benefit to get that information on both sides quickly so that the parties can decide, is this one we want to litigate or is this one that we want to move on to the next stage? And just from past experience, that seems to be how many courts and many prosecutors have handled it. And so when I see one like this where you don't even know who the complainant is before the preliminary hearing starts, it seems a little contrary to what I'm used to.
Well, I guess if that last comment about you don't know who the complainant is, well, then this procedure.
I'm just going by what the defense counsel has argued here.
Well, I mean, but then that would procedure would apply in any case where you have a complaint with initials for the victims. I have no doubt that your experience is correct and that people tend to be cooperative depending on the case. That, you know, other cases have specific needs such as privileged documents, informants, protection of informants, whatnot. But the response to that is, that's fine. Then what is the need to formalize this procedure? What is the need to create an animal such as this that is, again, an open-ended, standardless subpoena that will be used in every case? And believe me, it will be used in every case, just about. If counsel is going to be labeled ineffective for not serving one of these subpoenas before a prelim, and if subpoenas as broad as this one are acceptable, then they'll have to be filed in every case.
Well, suppose there was a subpoena that said to the police chief, bring in your records on this guy for this offense, and bring him in at the preliminary. Would the state then make a motion under 80507 for a protective order that it's too broad a subpoena?
The problem here, again, we got to look at the standard preliminary hearing. The defense has the right under 970.03 sub 5 to present witnesses with testimony relevant to the issue of plausibility.
Okay, so they've subpoenaed the police chief now. Okay.
Okay. And the compulsory process clause, if we're going to apply that here, requires not only relevant but favorable testimony.
Okay. Are you going to bring in a motion to protect this, or are you going to just make the motion at the preliminary hearing?
Well, I think there are two ways. You could bring a motion to quash, or you could just object to the testimony, as they did in Knutson, which that was a case where I believe there was a subpoena, and the prosecutor objected on the ground that this is discovery. You have to make, under the compulsory process clause, again, Valenzuela Bernal and Pennsylvania v. Ritchie require a specific showing before you can compel that witness to appear of relevance and exculpatory value of that evidence. And if you're not prepared to do that, if you're going to say, well, we don't know what he's going to say, and all appearances are that those police reports are probably going to be mostly inculpatory rather than exculpatory. They might be relevant. They probably are relevant. But they're more likely inculpatory than exculpatory, unless you can make a specific showing through, say, something you learned through the defendant himself, through another witness, through the victim, if she was willing to cooperate, through someone with information that there's something in that police file. We use an example in my moot court of a case where a defendant was charged with armed robbery, and the criminal complaint says the videotape shows a clear visual facial image of the defendant as being the robber. Defense attorney goes to the convenience store, talks to the security guard, and he says, yeah, I'm the one who pulled the videotape. Oh, can you look at these pictures? Here's my client. Is that the guy you saw on the videotape? No, it's not. It's somebody much older. Really? Well, can you come to this preliminary hearing and testify for the defense and bring that video with you? That, under 970.03 sub 5, not the compulsory process clause, but just under the right to present relevant and exculpatory evidence on the issue of plausibility of the state's case.
Suppose he says, no, I'm not coming. You want me, you subpoena me.
Then you can subpoena him.
Okay.
That's not, but that would be, that's strictly a statutory right. That's 970.03 sub 5 and 885.01. 805.07 doesn't even come into play because 970.03 sub 5 gets you to 970.211, which then gets you to 885.01. And that's, I think we're really being sidetracked. To be honest with you, I don't think 805.07 applies at all in criminal cases.
But your position, if I understand the state's position, your position is whether it's a preliminary to the preliminary or whether you subpoena the police chief to come and bring his records to the preliminary itself, it's a no-no.
There's something specific relative to the issue of plausibility.
Got it.
Yeah, I think, and that's no different than at the trial phase. You can't just bring in witnesses who you don't know what they're going to say. You have to, you know, whether you're a prosecutor or a defendant.
You can take depositions at the trial stage in a civil case, so you know what they're going to say. And if they don't say what they said before,
because
you can impeach them.
Yeah, so civil law has very special proceedings and specific legislative creative proceedings with open-ended deposition, discovery, interrogatory procedures that just don't exist in criminal cases, or at least they do. To the extent they do, it's much more limited and within the constitutional strictures and, of course, in the statutory provisions.
I think Justice Bradley had a question.
No, I was just going to thank you, Chief. I was just going to sum it up, and it was like, just say no. That's your position is contrary to Justice Butler, who wants to be everyone to get along and come on, just give over the documents. But earlier on, you answered the question. You said even at the preliminary hearing, this is too broad. It's open ended under State versus Knutson. The court said you're trying to use a preliminary for discovery, and you wouldn't allow it. What you would allow is, as I understand your answer now, you would allow them to get something they already know exists, but not to get for the kind of subpoena that exists here.
And I think that's consistent with the traditional uses of subpoenas, which are specifically focused on specific testimony, specific items of evidence relevant to the issues at hand at the specific proceeding.
I don't know. I mean, I've done a number of depositions and with subpoenas, and they're not always so specific.
But those are, again, that gets us into 804.01 sub 2, 804.09 sub 3, 805.07 sub 2b, none of which they're relying on here. Other than that, where the legislature is specifically, or this court and this rulemaking authority has specifically authorized such broad subpoenas, there is no authority, and all the authority that I've found, even in the, I believe in the Illinois case, talk about subpoena duces tecums are not discovery tools. They are specifically focused documents as a matter of statutory and constitutional law.
Bring your file. I said the subpoena duces tecum would say, bring your file. You know.
In a civil case, but again, we're talking about, I point this court to United States v. Nixon, where the prosecutor subpoenaed the president for specific documents. And that court interpreted the federal criminal subpoena duces tecum statute, Federal Rule 17C, which we have no counterpart. Federal Rule 16 is a counterpart to 970.123, but our legislature didn't create a counterpart to 17C. But 17C specifically talks about how you can use a subpoena duces tecum in a criminal case. And the Supreme Court in Nixon said, that's fine, you can do it, but you better make a specific showing that this is to produce evidence that is relevant, that it's not obtainable by other reasonably available means before trial, that it's not a fishing expedition, and that failure to produce it now will delay the trial. And that's at pages 698-99 of the Nixon decision. Counsel relies on the portion of Nixon that says the court is entitled to every person's evidence, and that's absolutely true. But that subpoena better be specific as to who that person is and what that evidence is. And page 698-99, the earlier part of that position, that opinion, talk about how specific a showing you have to make before you can get a subpoena, do just take them. And the prosecutor met that burden in that case, but that's a very high standard, I would suggest, and it's consistent with the compulsory process standard of relevance and materiality and exculpatory value. It's consistent also with cases such as State v. Green and State v. Shifra that this Court has dealt with before, where a defense, before he gets an in-camera review of evidence that he wants to discover from a third party, must make a specific showing of relevance and probative value and exculpatory value and whatnot. And that there, we just would conclude by saying there's really no need to put a, to create this cumbersome new procedure that will be largely duplicative and could be used for mischief in any number of cases. With that, I'll unless any further questions.
Mr. O'Brien, if I could.
Go ahead, Justice Butler.
You did give the cite for Knutson. Do you have the case cite for that handy?
51 was second 270, and the relevant pages are 280 through 82, I believe, or 279 through 82. And again, that was discussed at some length in the two hearings, the July 13 and July 18 trial court hearings. I believe Commissioner Bin was the one who said, well, what about Knutson? And then they went on and discussed that. And that talks about using, calling the chief of police to just sort of bring whatever you've got and saying, no, you can't do that.
Thank you.
This is a statutory interpretation case, at least for one part of it, right?
Yes.
All right. And one of the things in looking at this, at a, how you interpret a statute, would be the public policy considerations of what happens. And the state's obligation, as I understand it in a criminal case, is to charge and then try and get a conviction on somebody that the state has a reason to believe that they can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the person committed that crime. The state also has an obligation, as I understand it, in the United States, not to prosecute or convict if the state does not have adequate evidence. And that the state's position and the police position is to investigate and try and resolve a crime, but that you also protect, this is in all the oaths I've ever read, protect the rights of those who are not convicted. If that's the policy, then as a matter of policy, what is the matter with the police just turning over everything that is not confidential or privileged? I'm not talking about informants' names. I'm not talking about medical records. I'm just talking about police reports and statements made by various witnesses that the police talk to. What's the matter with that? I mean, this is not gamesmanship. This is not who wins and who loses, because who wins here should be the public. That is, the guilty be convicted and the not guilty not be prosecuted and not be convicted. That's the goal here. What's the matter with that?
Well,
turning it over. I mean,
there's nothing the matter after buying over, and we have specific procedures in place for doing precisely that.
Well, what's the matter with it before preliminary? If you can kill this at the preliminary and save the defendant, the accused, a trial, and save the state a trial, what's the matter with that? We're hiding the nut under the shell.
You know, I guess first of all, it'll be a duplicate procedure because you're going to do it again after the prelim. So we're going to have two Schiffer hearings instead of one. We're going to have two relevancy hearings instead of one on whether the subpoena should issue.
And
I guess I have two real quick examples that show the problems. For instance, if you had a case where you have a crime charge, a homicide, and multiple jurisdictions were involved, the FBI was involved, the Wisconsin Department of Justice were involved in the investigation, do you mean to say that you can subpoena the records of every one of those law enforcement agencies before a preliminary hearing just to see what they've got? Or the Green situation where you have a child who alleges that she's been sexually assaulted by the defendant for 5 years, and in the last 3 years she's been going to several counselors. Do you go before the preliminary hearing and serve subpoenas on all of those counselors to see whether there might be something there that we can impeach her, even though impeachment is not relevant at the preliminary hearing?
Well, I don't know that why we can't just stick with the police reports in this case. I know that you keep saying that
Well, the logical extent.
Open.
Well, they're calling it a third-party subpoena. This is they're not limiting it to. It's relevant in this case to police reports, but I believe when you read their brief in conjunction with the amicus brief, it's pretty clear they want issuance of an open-ended, standardless third-party subpoena that would include law enforcement agencies, and that will open a Pandora's box that will be hard to close.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That tells me why you're objecting. Ms. Stilling?
Thank you. First, I'd like to comment on something that Justice Butler said. The very reasons that Justice Butler gave why often prosecutors will voluntarily give over police reports before the preliminary hearing are exactly the efficiencies that the Washington County courts have experienced as a result of this policy on the part of the prosecutor in that county. Secondly, Chief Justice Abramson brought up a very good point. Why are we hiding the nut under the shell? In Milwaukee County, you receive the packet of police reports 30 seconds after the hearing is over. How cynical is that, that you can't have them before the hearing, but within 30 seconds of its conclusion, they're in your hand? The only reason you can't get them ahead of time is that the prosecution doesn't want us to be able to fully expose the weaknesses and the plausibility of the case, having real case information.
What is the procedure in Illinois?
In Illinois, I think there are different procedures in different counties, but my understanding is that in Chicago, unless reports are privileged, they're turned over directly to defense counsel by a process that's been developed within that county. In other counties, there are dates that are scheduled regularly in court. The police chiefs bring the subpoenas in that don't have privilege or the responses to the subpoenas in, and defense counsel pick them up in court. On the rare occasions when there is an argument about the confidentiality, then those are argued in the court and then resolved right there. And I would disagree that there will be duplication, because even if defense counsel files a discovery demand at the end of the preliminary hearing after the arraignment, that will still only obligate the state to produce the limited things that are in the discovery statute. And those are all items that they will not know till they get closer to trial. Witness lists, expert reports, things of those natures that really are not duplicated in the police reports.
Didn't the Carey case indicate that these subpoenaed materials would be turned over to the court?
Yes.
And that the court would review them?
I don't know that the court was going to review them or only review issues of privilege.
Well, I'm reading from another case, the Hart case. The court then determines the relevance and materiality of the materials, whether they are privileged, and whether the subpoena is unreasonable or oppressive.
If there were arguments on those points, I'm sure that the court would hear them. However, the state has raised the issue that these reports are not directly relevant. But the reports that I've requested in these subpoenas are only relevant to the case at hand. They're not a fishing expedition. I'm not looking for information about anything else about this young woman. I only want to know what the information is in the hands of the police, as the court in Harper directed us to do, to get that information to utilize at this critical stage.
Would transcripts of a wiretap be part of police reports?
My understanding is that those would be ruled by different statutory confidentiality concerns. And I would like to make, that does raise one point that the state made here. The state keeps saying that the standard is relevance, materiality, and exculpatory value, and cites to Venezuela Bernal. But I would point out that Venezuela Bernal specifically mentioned the language in the compulsory process clause that states that the information or evidence should be in his favor, and suggested that that meant it should be favorable. Our Constitution has no such language. It has broader language in his benefit, which means something more to the effect of on his side. There is no requirement in this state that this court interpret our Constitution as requiring favorable language. I would also point out that many of the cases cited by the state with this standard involve balancing of confidential documents or the executive branch's need to be able to control its immigration policy, as in Venezuela, or other privacy concerns, such as in Pennsylvania versus Ritchie. There are no such concerns raised in the subpoena that I've issued in this case. The standard for this subpoena should be the standard that was found in the Migliorino case that was filed or that was cited by the state, which is relevance, a standard that the court found was sufficient to meet the needs of the government in a case where there is a third-party request for information that is not privileged. And I would ask the court to find that the only standard here is relevance and that we have met that. Thank you.
Just 1 second. I'm sorry. But I just reread the amicus brief. I hope I read the right one. I didn't read it to say everything is open. I thought it was specific to police reports, and I thought that's what this case is about. Do you agree with the state that if we open up police reports under subpoena, it would allow other kinds of subpoenas too?
Well, I think that the statutes provide for subpoenas to a broad range of entities. However, the court's rulings in Shifra and Green and other cases involving confidential reports would continue to be the law in this state. And in the event that a defendant at that early stage of the proceeding could actually meet the standard of those cases, then I think in those extremely rare cases where they want to try to meet that standard, they could. But I would suggest it would be extremely unlikely that most defendants could meet that standard at that early stage before receiving any investigative information about the case. So I would tend to believe that those subpoenas would not be issued.
But under Carey, it says subpoenaed material should be sent directly to the court because the subpoena is a judicial process or court writ, whereas discovery is the party's procedure, a distinguishable concept under their rules. The court then determines, this is the Illinois process, at least as set forth in Carey, determines the relevance and materiality of the materials and whether they are privileged, as well as whether the subpoena is unreasonable or oppressive. The state's attorney, of course, must be fully aware of the record sought from the investigative agency by the subpoena in order for him to object. So it looks to me as if it's a in-camera proceeding to begin with. That is, that the court gets all of this and parties will dispute it before the court.
I suspect that as a matter of efficiencies, the court systems in Illinois have developed methods to streamline those so that only those reports that are objected to by the government, which should have full knowledge during the charging phase of whatever objectionable material there might be, that only those are resolved by use of that express procedure.
If not, it's sort of waived and everybody agrees that's what's going to happen. Okay. Any other questions? Well, then I want to thank Attorney Stilling and Attorney Daniel O'Brien for their arguments today in an unusual case involving a pre-preliminary subpoena. And that concludes our 2006 AP 1826 CRAC, State of Wisconsin versus Ronald Schaefer. The court will be in recess until its next oral argument, and it will meet in the conference room at 3:15. We are in recess. Thank you.